Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Leia and Nukeproof. You'll no doubt be well aware of Nukeproof's bikes, especially the Mega, which has taken Sam Hill to the Enduro World Series overall on multiple occasions, but they also make a great range of components. I'm running the bar, stem, headset, bottom bracket and pedals on my new bike and I'm really happy with them. The bottom bracket and the headset are new this year and they've got titanium-coated bearing races for added durability. As a result of that, Nukeproof are confident enough to give you a 5-year warranty on headsets and 2 years on the bottom bracket. If you're anything like me and you ride a lot in wet, sloppy conditions, then having headset and bottom bracket bearings that last is a massive bonus. You can check out everything they have to offer over at nukeproof.com. And for you Downtime listeners, Nukeproof are giving away a set of their new Horizon wheels worth £400 in whatever size you need for your bike. To be in with a chance of winning, just head over to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the ridiculously easy question before the end of July. If you want to show your support for the podcast, then you can do that by grabbing yourself a t-shirt over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. All the t-shirts are made from a super soft 100% organic cotton. They've got a really great fit and they're made using renewable energy too. So if you want to look great and help the podcast at the same time, then you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop now and get involved. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then what are you waiting for? It's free, super simple to do, and means you won't miss an episode. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're there, you can fill out the form to join my newsletter, where I'll send you a weekly weekend warm-up of some of the interesting bike-related things that I've seen that week, along with links to any competitions we've got running and some insight into the products that I've been using and enjoying. Please also give us a follow on Instagram or Facebook where we're at Downtime Podcast. And if you have a couple of minutes, then leaving us a review wherever you listen to the show really helps me out. This episode is also supported by Layat. And today I'm joined by their founder, Chris Layat, to find out what goes into making the ultimate mountain bike shoe. Layat launched a full range of flat pedal and clipless shoes earlier in the year, and they've been really well received by the media, athletes and the regular riders just like you and me. I sat down with Chris to find out what goes into a project like this. What are the key components of a shoe and how they design them to be the best that they can. I love the attention to detail that Layat put into their design and the shoe project is no different. They even design their own laces. If you want to find out more about Layat shoes, then you can do that by heading to layat.com. That's L-E-A-T-T.com. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of the Aaron Chase signature flat pedal shoes, then you can do that over at layat.com/AC shoe before the end of July. All those links are in the show notes for this episode over at downtimepodcast.com. Right, it's time to get stuck into this episode. So without further ado, here's Chris Layat. Chris Layat, welcome back to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Thanks, Chris. Interesting times. Things are good with me and the company, but it sure isn't business as usual. Been a very interesting time, as I'm sure everybody else is experiencing. And at the beginning of COVID, we had some perceptions at how it would all pan out, and where we're sitting now, we have different perceptions and then looking towards the future. So interesting times.
Yeah. What's the impact been like for you guys then?
So we being a sort of a South African company and quite conservative in nature, we took the COVID scare very seriously, and we planned financially as well as all the usual COVID planning requirements around the world. And of course, being an international company, that varies from country to country. So in South Africa, we opened up just under a month ago, but we had one of the strictest lockdowns, I think, from around the world. And literally the Leat business in terms of sales in South Africa, so it's like somebody took a switch and just switched the whole lot off. We weren't allowed to do anything. Other places in the world, we were able to sell to varying degrees. We furloughed some of our staff. We obviously they couldn't get out on the road and travel, but we've been, I must say, touch wood, pleasantly surprised that it's not been as dramatic as we had planned for. But I guess that's the trick in these times is have a stable ship and manage it conservatively. So we've done that. We didn't close down as a business, although we've been working on a 4-day working week. to try and mitigate some of the financial strain. And as I say, we've been pleasantly surprised. It hasn't been quite as dramatic as we anticipated. Of course, the big question is what's coming after COVID, or, you know, are we going to see a second wave, and what's going to happen to the global economy hereafter? But as we stand here today, we're not unhappy with where we're at.
Good stuff. Yeah, lots of unknowns, but the bike industry seems to have done fairly well so far. A lot of people have got back into riding, or have started to get into riding in order to get to work and avoid public transport. And hopefully that all crosses over eventually to them getting onto mountain bikes and realizing it's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was a lot of pent up frustration. You know, South Africa, one of the hardest lockdowns, essentially everything came to a grinding halt. You weren't allowed to exercise, and then they reintroduced exercise from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning, which is fantastic given the fact that it's dark and it's winter. So only the real exercise stalwarts and hardened athletes were out there exercising. But now that the restrictions have been eased and you can exercise any time of the day, I think the pent-up frustration, people just want to get out and ride their bikes. And I don't believe in the trails around where I live. I've ever seen so many people running and cycling. It's just been quite dramatic.
Wow. Yeah, it's good. It's good for the sport in the long run, hopefully. But yeah, still some tough times. But fingers crossed it all pans out well. Yeah, we're here to talk about shoes, which is another area of mountain biking that I think people maybe don't give enough respect to how much detail goes into the design of something that effectively seems very simple. But first off, why did you guys look to make shoes? I mean, you're obviously more well known for protection side of things, I guess, helmets, the neck braces, that sort of stuff. Why shoes?
Well, I think just to start at the end and work backwards, I think in terms of protection, I do believe that the technology and protection we've been able to offer in our shoe line may not be completely unique, but I think is a fresh take on this component of our product offering. And it's important to us, and has been for some time, to be a head-to-toe company. So, I mean, as you know, we manufacture not only the neck braces, but, you know, helmets, goggles, riding apparel, knee braces, elbow guards, knee guards. So it's a logical next step for us to offer shoes. We wanted to really look at it in a different way to which the market has traditionally looked at shoes and shoe design. So our desire was to get into the market and be a head-to-toe brand, but not to do it in a me too sort of way, is to look at the status quo and what the market wants and try and give them something special.
Okay. Yeah. So what did you set out to achieve then? What were your aims and objectives for the shoes?
So as I think I've alluded to, we're not big fans of offering products that are just to fill a gap in our product offering. We really try and either solve a significant gap or problem in the market, or to add a technological or protective element to that market segment. So for us, there are a few keys in terms of setting goals for entering the shoe market, and that is technology. Can we offer technology that advances shoes and makes them more comfortable and better to wear, makes them durable, especially for our type of sports, where obviously shoes take quite a hammering, and then offer protection and weatherproofing to the shoe design. So with the tech, the durability, weatherproofing and protection, those are the main pillars of our offering.
Okay. And where do you start then? Do you go out and like get hold of a load of the competitors' products and start trying to work out how they're doing things? Where does a project like this start from?
So, I mean, within Liat, and we pride ourselves on this fact, and if you look across the spectrum of the company, whether they're designers, salesmen, engineers, logistics people, IT, just about everybody in the company is linked to riding in some way, whether having worked for this type of company for a while or are avid riders. So within the Liat family, we have a huge number of riders from different disciplines. So I think we were able to identify earlier on in the product development, once we decided to do shoes, what it is we really wanted to achieve amongst ourselves, but also to talk to riders, fellow riders, and athletes that we're involved with. And then to, you know, assemble a list of key points, a coherent target list, if you wish, of elements we wanted to hit with the shoes. And then, you know, find a concise offering to the market that would really be attractive, both in tech as well as, you know, comfort, durability and target price.
Yeah. So if we start with the flat pedal shoe, because I think they're, well, that's that I generally ride flat, so it's my more familiar area. What were the attributes that you wanted to try and achieve with that shoe?
Well, I think if you look at both categories of shoe, we started with the sole, okay, and then really built the shoe up around the sole, and that I think is the important starting point. And you know, once again, having a number of people in the company who ride and athletes who can give us a lot of feedback. We had a lot of opinion on what works and what doesn't work from the get-go. Obviously, identifying a compound and a design for the sole of the shoe is important. And it just, you know, there's obviously a lot of shoes in the market, both mountain biking shoes and casual shoes and athletic shoes. You sort of assume in the beginning that it's going to be a fairly easy journey to come up with a compound that works for your application. But given the aggressiveness of pedals now and you know, the durability requirements and the riding conditions, it's actually quite a difficult matrix to design a compound of a shoe that is going to offer grip but last as long as is required. And so that's really where we started, is identifying a compound and design parameters for the underside of the shoe to make it durable, grippy, comfortable, and all the things that we wanted to achieve within the shoe. And from choosing the compound, which obviously requires lab testing from a chemical analysis, durability, abrasion testing, etc. Then also technology that can be imported, not necessarily traditionally for a mountain biking shoe, to make the manufacturing process good. So, you know, in terms of compression molding techniques, things stolen from other avenues of shoemaking, to allow us to arrive at you know, sort of the most efficient ultimate shoe design, but certainly started with a sole.
Yeah. So it's fairly well known that some of the grippier shoes tend to suffer from a durability perspective, either from falling apart or the actual kind of rubber degrading with the, you know, the nature of the aggressive pins on the pedals these days. Have you gone right back to like the chemistry level then to try and understand why that is and how to improve things?
Absolutely. So it actually really did start with chemistry and trying to come up with a compound that would hit all the target areas. And as you say, you want a shoe that's soft enough to grip, but is not going to fall apart in a very short space of time. So the traditional waffle design, as we all well know, and then taking that and making it more efficient for our type of use, so allowing mud and water to drain out in terms of mud flow channels, grippy sections and less grippy sections, depending on whether you're pedaling or pushing at that point in time. These are all the elements that are taken into account, both with the chemistry as well as the inherent design of the sole of the shoe. And then, of course, there's also a degree of biomechanics and energy transfer. So it's quite an interesting concept, really. If you look at road cycling shoes, which are very stiff and rigid to allow maximum energy transfer, and then you look at a really comfortable sneaker-type flat pedal shoe, which may be really comfortable to ride in, but not really efficient in transferring energy, is then to come up with a shank design that was really good for pedal efficiency, but also comfortable to wear.
And is there an element of protection with that shank as well, like from impact and heavy landings and stuff?
Well, I think you've got to look at the shoe as a whole. So once again, goes to the compound selection, the shank design, and how consistent the strength is over the entire breadth and length of the shoe, and also areas of the shoe where you want the foot to be able to flex. So within the constraints of a shoe and energy transfer, it's all about a balance. I mean, that pretty much sums up protective apparel and the biomechanics in producing them, is you've got to find that balance. If you had to look at a neck brace, the most ideal neck brace in terms of energy transfer only would be a metal neck brace. So if you made a stainless steel neck brace, you would transfer the most energy, but you know, you would cause subsequent injuries and it wouldn't be comfortable to wear. So you've got to find this balance, and that's why, you know, it takes a lot of design iterations and a lot of testing to come up with this this balance of protection, energy transfer, comfort, durability in the matrix. And you know, you can of course go to a OEM shoe manufacturer and say, you know, I'd like you to produce some colorways and designs for us. But we really went back to absolute basics, from the chemistry to the biomechanics to produce the shoe.
Yeah. So how many iterations then did you go through? For example, the flat pedal sole. How long did it take to get there, and what kind of testing do you do on the way?
So I did ask this question of Scott, our lead designer on the shoe, and he said in excess of 20 iterations, wow. But those are significant design iterations, that's a fairly significant number over a fairly short space of time when you're starting with something that is fairly well known. So there was a lot of testing and a lot of design iterations. And of course there are really two arms to testing. One is lab-based testing. In this case, it was chemical compounds, abrasion resistance, and using other benchmarks for shoe design and durability. So in the mountain biking shoes, there aren't any clearly defined standards. So we went and looked at all the standards for sporting shoes and developed a design matrix and a testing matrix around how should a well-designed shoe perform and last. So from chemistry to biomechanics to lab testing, and then of course riders. I mean, there is as important to any other element of design, because you may make the best shoe in your opinion, may tick all the boxes, and of course, if the athlete doesn't like it or doesn't find it comfortable, well, you're back to square one. So, fortunately, we have a number of, as I've mentioned, riders within the company that use the shoes. We then also do some quite aggressive testing in the South African market because it's close to home and we have access to a number of athletes and we can make very quick design changes. So, of course, to take a shoe, ride in it, bring it back to the company and fiddle with it, that's a distinct advantage. And then, of course, the international riders. We learned a long time ago that you may – you may put your product on a number of athletes in the first 4 out of 5 say it's absolutely fantastic, and the fifth one sees a significant design challenge. So having a broad enough base of athletes to test and give you constant feedback on is really paramount to the ultimate success of the product.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking you were putting soles onto off-the-shelf shoes originally before the rest of your shoe existed, just so you could get out and test?
Well, there are a lot of rather interesting looking prototypes. So out of the 20 iterations, the first few were not easily identified as a new product and may easily have been identified as something quite common and not in this industry. So, you know, the advantage for us in this particular market segment is that shoes have been around for a while. It's not like we're inventing something from scratch. So, an initial hybrid approach. Can't deny that that's been used.
Well, if it works, it's a good way to get them out there, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's expensive to tool these things up, so you've got to do what you can to get it right before you're putting down money for tooling, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what about the SPD sole? Because that's a slightly different challenge, yeah.
It is a different challenge, and it has some distinct challenges. I think, obviously, with an SPD sole, energy transfer and energy management is important. We started once again with the lessons we'd learned with the flat pedal shoe in terms of compound, mud channels, difference in profiling in the toe and the heel section to make it comfortable, because ultimately you still need to be able to move and walk in it. And then really looked at what wasn't working terribly well in the cleat slots component of the shoe. So different manufacturers have taken different approaches in terms of the cleat slot, and as well as how the shank integrates with that cleat slot so that the energy transfer can be as efficient as possible. And trying to find that balance between having a really rigid sole and one that is comfortable. One of the key elements for us was the size of the slot was often too short. And if you understand the market and what the market is demanding, and looking at various disciplines, the very aggressive downhill in comparison to trail and other riding. Sometimes requires the cleat to be in a different position for power transfer as well as for balance and feel. So we identified that quite early on that we wanted to modify the cleat slots to allow more travel backwards and a bit more forwards to give the rider the opportunity to custom select his setting within the cleat box.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking there used to be a patent on that that was stopping manufacturers from doing something with cleat slots?
Correct. And that is now expired. So it's open for use.
Because a lot of pro riders you see taking the Dremel to their, to their cleat slots.
Themselves. And, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Can you explain the shank a little bit? Is that's an insert of something stiffer into the sole? Is that right?
Yeah, it's a component of the sole which allows you to transfer energy and have varying degrees of flex over its length to increase pedal efficiency, but to not compromise comfort. And you know, you're now taking almost two diverse requirements and marrying them and molding them together to achieve a feel and an efficiency in the shoe. So not only do you have two different components of design, but integrating them is also always a challenge. Fortunately, you know, the modern manufacturing techniques, and particularly if you can use novel manufacturing techniques to achieve a blend of designs has allowed technology to evolve. And I think gone are the days where, you know, shoe design, most like many other elements of protective apparel now, are static. They need to evolve. They evolve to a point and were static for a very long time. But I think you'll see a lot of innovation in this space, particularly shank flex and rigidity and different components of the shoe.
Yeah, so you can tune that more along the length and the width of the shoe than you maybe could 5 years ago, say.
Absolutely. And also different shoes fill different purposes. So depending on and that's why it was important for us to offer a product offering within this product segment that didn't just cater for one type of riding, because with various types of riding comes different requirements.
Yeah, so you've got the 2.0, which is like a softer shoe, I guess, and that's coming from the shank, is it?
So from the 2.0, which is essentially a sneaker style, very soft shoe, non-cleated, to the 5.0, there's a significant difference in construction technique.
Okay, interesting. So once you've got the sole right, then where do you go from there? Because there's a lot more to a shoe than just its sole.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's a selection of materials. It's a manufacturing technique, and then achieving two things. One in for us was a degree of protection, both from abrasion resistance, but protecting the medial malleolus, the ankle joint from the crank of the pedal. And then a shoe fitment and ways to mitigate shoes coming loose over a period of time. I think we all know that when you start wearing a shoe and after an hour or two of riding, the shoe sits differently on your foot, and trying to find a way to make the shoe more efficient and fit better for longer. So we were also able in the instance, let's look at the 5.0 shoe, is to take developments in materials from our waterproof and breathable jackets that are very light but very durable, and overmold them to reinforce them against impact and protection points. So the sort of balance of waterproof, being waterproof and breathable, choosing the right materials, and then looking at the way the shoe actually interacts with the foot. One of the problems, as I'm sure you're aware, is as you pedal, your heel can leave the shoe, which makes it less efficient. So finding ways of having the shoe applied to the foot more consistently over time was one of the design elements that we integrated into the shoe design. So, you've got a selection of material, you've got a number of key technology design points which you want to achieve. You then have to hit all your targets in a way that can be manufactured. And looking at manufacturing techniques, and in our case, overmolding and using various materials to achieve the technology in a way in which it's indeed manufacturable. And of course, this can lead to a shoe that's extremely expensive with so much new tech in it. So because we've developed a lot of our own technology and our own materials previously, that gave us the ability and having in-house design and experience with using these materials, it allowed us to control the costs because, in our opinion, we may have a superior shoe, but if you cost it right out the market, you're going to attract or be able to offer the product to a small number of people. So, that too is an important element, is to try and manufacture and include all this technology into a shoe, but not allow the price point to escape. So I think, in terms of manufacturing and design, what we've really aimed at is comfort and control, protection and durability at a price point that is attractive to the market. Liat is very fortunate to have some really good designers and very proud of that fact.
Yeah. So what technology features then, I guess, would you say that you've managed to get into the shoes from either from things you've developed in the past or things that you've developed specifically for this product?
Well, I mean, I think if I had to just, list the technology features, one is the compound of the sole. The second is the shank design to be efficient but not over rigid. Thirdly is to have a slotted cleat box that is of the desired range to offer the rider the ability to make his shoe as efficiently as possible, to offer protection against crank and pedal to your ankle, to offer a shoe that is robust in terms of seams that are not going to come apart in the reasonable life expectancy of such a hard wearing item, to select materials that are both breathable and water resistant without making the shoe terribly heavy. So if you put all these things into a design matrix, there's a lot of technology and a lot of new technology applied in new ways into a product that's still at the end of the day got to be really comfortable and not out of the target manufacturing cost.
Yeah. So how have you approached that breathability versus kind of water resistance element of this? Because, I mean, even with the best wear in the world, with a fully waterproof shoe, you've still got a big hole at the ankle where water can get in. So shoes do soak up water, and certainly some can get really, really heavy. But
absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, the aperture where the foot goes into the shoe, as well as the material of the shoe, is important. So, I mean, where can water leak in? Obviously, around the ankle and the entrance to the shoe. And so what we've tried to achieve is a soft but rigid fit all the way around. And earlier we were talking about how the shoe's been designed so that the heel doesn't come away from the shoe when you're applying power to the pedal. And in the same regard, trying to, without putting a rubber gasket around it, have a shoe that seals the top as efficiently as possible. Obviously, having a cleat box that doesn't leak water. I can remember some of my older shoes, you didn't even have to get the top wet to get water ingress into the shoes. And then, the latest materials that we've been using are jackets to allow the shoe to inherently be water resistant, but still breathe. I think that's been a major step. And then, of course, manufacturing techniques. So, to afford the shoe the ability to breathe, but in a controlled manner. So, having the seams and previously where there was stitching or bonding, having co-molding and manufacturing technique that allows water to not ingress at seams or joints. Altogether gives you an efficient shoe. And in fact, putting our shoes on and dunking your foot in water and removing them is one of the tests that we do. A very crude test, but it's one where if you want to put on competitor shoes and your own shoe, you can very quickly tell whether your foot is wet or not.
Yeah, and if they do get wet, I guess you want them to dry out quickly. Exactly. Is that something you've looked at?
Yes, exactly. Is their breathability.
Okay, so that's to breathe not only for comfort while you're wearing
the
shoe.
Not only for comfort, but moisture wicking and getting the moisture out. So, you want that fine balance between breathability and moisture wicking. If it does get wet, is to get rid of that wetness. You know, we were talking before we came online about winter, and here in Stellenbosch, it can get pretty cold, not European cold, but I've had a few cycles recently where it's been 1, 2, 3 degrees. You just need to go through one river once, and then that'll certainly ruin your ride. it's an important element and something that's tested.
Yeah. And you've even thought about the other people that are sharing accommodation with us when we're on a riding trip, because you've put anti-odor in the shoes somehow.
I mean, even a slightly damp shoe that isn't aired and breathed, you don't put it in direct sunlight afterwards, or remove inserts. I mean, it's not the most attractive piece of kit, is it? So, so odor damping is important.
Yeah. And how do you go about that? Is that a special technology? Is it just a treatment you apply to the material? I don't really know how that works.
Not something that I feel well versed to comment on. But it was one of the design elements and has been incorporated into the shoe. But in terms of the exact chemical and how it's applied, that's a bit beyond my scope of expertise.
That's all right. That's no worries. You mentioned when we were talking earlier that you have a sort of a reasonable lifetime expectation for the shoes. What did you set as a target for that? Like, how do you kind of measure that? What should people expect?
That's a very good question. And I'm not sure that I can give you the answer to the question because it is such a non-objective, subjective commentary. You can have the same riders doing the same amount of kilometers in a week and the one will totally destroy your shoe and the other one won't. You can have people that that ride infrequently whose shoes last for years. You can have pro athletes who destroy a pair of shoes in a few rides. So I think in this instance, it's not about making claims as to how long we believe the shoe will last, but rather benchmarking it against competitors and benchmarking it against manufacturing techniques where it doesn't delaminate, where the sole doesn't deteriorate, and those are all designed into the product. But I guess ultimately, we'll have to circle back in a year's two's time and see what the market's perception of durability is.
Yeah. I've been riding the 3.0 flat pedal shoe for a few rides now, and normally I would expect to start seeing some kind of witness marks from the pedal pins on the sole, but so far there's nothing there. So it's a good start. Definitely, it's only early days, but yeah.
Interesting, and then that speaks to the design of the sole, both in terms of its profile and how it grips the pedal, but as well as the chemical compound and finding this balance between grippiness and long lasting. Can you imagine the dilemma that racing tire manufacturers have, where they want ultimate grip and but it's got to last the length of the race.
Yeah, so I'm not really an easy challenge, that. Sorry?
I'm very pleased to hear your shoes are wearing well.
Yeah, they're good. And the grip level on them is surprisingly good for how, like, the sole feels like it's going to be tougher and you would expect it to be less grippy than some of the competition. But actually, when you're riding, it doesn't seem to work that way. I guess the waffle pattern's helping, but also there's a level of grippiness in that sole material as well that sort of I didn't expect from it.
Good.
You've even developed your own lace for the shoe, I think. Is that right? Why did you go that far?
This is the problem with Liat, is that you can't just really accept the status quo. You've always got to look at what can be done better, and to not assume that all laces are created equal, because they're not. So one of the challenges, well, two of the challenges in terms of mountain biking shoes is as and when they get wet, their life expectancy decreases over time. So lace rot and just deterioration is one element. The second element is that the start of the ride, you lace up your shoe nice and tight, and by the end of the ride, there's been stretch in the laces and they're no longer tight. So we borrowed some design ideas from hiking and climbing shoes and boots, where they have anti-rot laces that are non-stretch. I try to apply that to a shoes type lace design and sizing to reduce lace deterioration as well as the laces stretching, getting looser over time.
Okay. And does that mean you can get like more of a kind of like the BOA system kind of repeatability, I guess, without the cost of adding something like that?
The cost and the bulk, exactly. So you have something that doesn't slip or stretch and maintains its integrity over a longer period of time during the ride without having, adding more and more tech and bulk to the shoe.
Yeah. You guys don't mess about when it comes to detail, do you?
I would say the devil's in the detail. You can make a fantastic product, and if there's an Achilles heel, excuse the pun, to the product, it's going to come out sooner rather than later. So, I think one of the problems we've had, particularly, with the advent of the neck brace, is that we understood early on it had to really last as such an important safety requirement. And, man, the products last. We may not get quite as much turnover in product sales as other manufacturers, but I guess it's good for the end consumer.
Well, it's good for the environment as well, which is a definite positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so how long does a project like this take?
Well, within our company, maybe somewhat different, and premised by the fact that we knew we wanted to be head to toe for quite a while, and we had developed our sort of started developing our wish list quite early on, and chatted to the athletes and quite early on. But this is sort of a 2-year design cycle, even though we had a good starting point. So not insignificant in terms of time period. But a lot of that is also because of our relationship with the factories, the designers' efficiency, and an arriving at the start point with a really good set of design requirements and an understanding of the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair play. So once you've got the complete shoe, then how do you go about testing it? Like you said, you've got a lot of people within the Layup family that ride. You've got a lot of athletes. Is it those guys and girls that are doing all the test work on the product as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you cannot circumvent or shorten the human interaction test cycle. I mean, the earlier you can put it out, the better the product for testing, the better the product you're going to have ultimately. Obviously, the environmental sort of UV light abrasion, repetitive opening and closing, material resistance. Tests can be conducted in a lab, and those are fairly well documented test methodologies. But having the right amount of riders for the correct period of time using your shoes, I think, really is critical. And as I mentioned before, it's also, if all your test riders come from one region and one discipline specific, you're going to get one set of answers. But as soon as you put it out to a number of disciplines and a wider rider population in various countries, you get quite a different set of answers. And it may be the one outlier that actually holds the secret to the success of the product, as we found before. So, that's one of the secrets, I think, to having a really good product is diverse testing.
Yeah, yeah. How do you deal with contradictory feedback then? Because not everyone's going to love everything, but how do you decide when something's right versus when you might want to change something?
Yeah, I think we have quite a well-developed feedback methodology now where the feedback from all the riders is logged in the same way specifically, and allows us to compare apples with apples. So, if 9 out of 10 people are saying, that the water ingress isn't a problem and one person says it is, then is it a design issue or is it maybe a manufacturing problem with that particular prototype? So it's really walking around with a microscope and studying everything and having a big enough population to make sense of the information you get, you're getting, as well as having consistent feedback. There's, you know, you've got to try and reduce a subjective experience to objective answers.
Yeah, and ideally you don't want too much late change as well, I guess, because the further down the line towards production you've got, the more expensive it is to change things as well.
Absolutely. You've got to at some point in time draw a line in the sand and say, we think we've done a good job. There may be scope for improvement, but that may be the next iteration in a year or two's time. Because, you know, ultimately you can R&D a project ever reaching the market. So, but most certainly, you know, having your test methodology and your rider feedback as early as possible. And then when you're making changes, your changes are incrementally smaller each time. So, you know, in the beginning, you may make quite a big change and half the people may like it and half don't. But when you've narrowed down the changes to what is working and what isn't working, your changes become smaller and smaller.
And that's when you know you're getting close, I suppose.
Absolutely, and then if there's some difference of opinion on a small element, that's as you say a lot less devastating to the project than that occurs early on in the project.
Yeah, fair play. So a lot of hours have been spent on these shoes then before they went into the market.
A huge amount of time. And also, it's not just a small group of people within the company that critique the shoe. Even the non-riders will critique the shoe. From marketing and sales to logistics to all the elements. Designers who don't design shoes but design other products, all sitting together in a room and talking through this project and saying, maybe. Maybe there's an element of the shoe we just need to rethink, and that ultimately leads to a product that's been reviewed by quite a broad base of knowledge, and that certainly helps.
Yeah, and what's the response been like then from the media and from the public? Because they've been out a little while now, yeah, a few months. Yeah.
The response has been really good. Actually, surprising. We when you launch a new product, you hope it's going to be received really well, and you certainly design and aim for that. But the real litmus test is when it hits the market. So, of course, with our product, there's a lot of new technology within the shoe, and a lot of departures from the norm in terms of fit and design. So, those people who've tested the shoe, the journalists who've tested the shoes, the athletes that have tested the shoes, the customers who've bought the shoes and are using them, the feedback has been really, really good and exceeds our expectations. There is a population of people who haven't yet tried it because they think it's a little bit too untraditional in terms of shoe design. But certainly the people who have actually used the shoe, the response has been really overwhelmingly positive.
Good stuff. And you've just launched a signature model as well, haven't you, with Aaron Chase?
Absolutely. So he's been really keen to have his own shoe for a while now, and we're very happy to be able to do a shoe with Aaron. Very exciting.
Yeah, that's cool. Saw some imagery of that the other day. Really nice bit of kit. All right, well, it's been really interesting finding out a little bit more about what goes into what on the surface can seem like something pretty simple. If people want to find out more, where's the best place for them to head?
Well, there are numerous places to go. If you want to, review the technology and what Liet is saying about how they designed the shoe, obviously our website is a good place to go. Also Instagram and Facebook in terms of the promotions and the athletes and the media that have been using it. We obviously repost a lot of reviews done by the media. If you want to purchase the shoe, you either go to your local dealer or look on Liet's website as to where that local dealer may be.
Perfect. All right. We'll put some links in the show notes so people can find all that stuff nice and easily. Good stuff. All right. Well, thanks, Chris. It's been really interesting chatting. And I look forward to spending some more time on the shoes.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. And as always, thanks for taking the time to have a chat to us at Liet. And we're very proud of this new product category, and I'm sure you and I will talk again soon.
Good stuff. Nice one. Thanks, man.
Go well.
All right, that's it for this episode with Chris. I hope you enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Nukeproof and Layout for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head over to layout.com and check out their awesome range of products. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then head to layout.com/ACshoe and get entered before the end of July. Also, don't forget to head to nukeproof.com and check out their entire range. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a set of their new Horizon wheels, then you just need to head to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the really easy question. It even tells you where to go to find the answer. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all the new t-shirts over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Leaving a review of the show wherever you listen is really great for helping new people find the podcast. So if you've got a couple of minutes, then it'd be really great if you could leave us a review wherever you listen. Please make sure that you're subscribed to the show so you don't miss an episode. And please, please keep on spreading the word with your riding mates. The more people that listen, the easier it is for me to keep this thing going and bringing you a new episode every week. All right, there's going to be another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, look after each other. And if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.